Okay, so let's get started. But before we do, does anyone have any questions about the stuff we've talked about so far? Okay, great. And in terms of the experiments that all of you are doing, have any of you had a chance to sit and talk about it after? Like Auntie Johanny and I talked for about 2 hours last night trying to figure out what our task should be and stuff like that. And I think we're closer, a lot closer. How about the rest of you? Just by a show of hands, how many of you had a chance to do that? Sort of-ish? Yeah, okay. It's sometimes hard to make progress on this part. And the reason is because it just takes practice. Like once you've built like 20 experiments, it's a lot easier on the 21st, trust me. But the first one you ever do, it's the temptation is always to second guess yourself and say, oh, but this isn't the perfect task. And you have to remember, it doesn't matter because you can always try another task if it fails, right? So remove in your head that everything must be perfect and instead say, first just try something, run the data, see what happens, and then adapt as you go. Because it does take some time to learn this stuff, and that's okay. Okay, I'm not going to go in detail about these first couple slides because we've already kind of talked about it, but RCTs, like we said, have like a really long history. There's all sorts of stuff about the Nuremberg Salt Test. But I do want to mention really quickly that at this point, you should at least be able to distinguish between anecdotal claims and empirical claims. So, for example, throughout the first century, 19th and 20th century, you might have had people or with programming languages say something like, I believe static typing leads to greater productivity than dynamic typing. That would be an anecdotal claim, right? Or just a claim. Or a philosopher might say, we cannot know all the possible parameters, so it's unknowable what the impact of static or dynamic typing is. I pull out these two because I've actually seen them in the literature. Someone just claiming, I believe this, or I think it's unknowable, right? And so I want to point out, those kind of claims are broadly not useful. The first claim is just a belief, and the second claim might have some validity because many things are kind of unknowable. But on the other hand, it prevents progress because the whole idea of empirical data is that we can take off a piece of the problem at a time and slowly make progress. That's why human life expectancy through a lot of this empiricism has gone up somewhat slowly over a generation or two, as opposed to just we believe things will get better. So the opposite is the empirical claims. I conducted a randomized controlled trial observing people using two similar languages, one with dynamic typing and one with static. Results show an increase in the speed by which those using static typing could write correct software. The probability of the result was due to chance, which is actually not quite a correct description of p-values, but that's not the point, was 0.7%, and the result explains 30% of the variance in the sample. You can see that empirical data gets really specific. That makes it easy to argue against it because you can argue against the specific things, but it also puts a target on it so that people can see exactly what you did and the context under which it matters. It's not vague at all, or at least good empirical work is not vague. We also already talked about Bradford Hill, but there is one other thing I wanted to mention, and that is oftentimes he talks about this idea of causality, and one way that people... Did I screw something up?
No, just me.
I said it.
Yeah, I'm just checking.
Oh, did it?
No.
Yeah, okay.
Just looking a bit weird to yourself.
You're good. He often has this criterion that he used. They actually today call it the Bradford Hill criterion. And basically all it is a way that you can kind of think about your methodology. It's not super important. It's not something I would cite in a paper necessarily. But nonetheless, it's kind of good to put in your head that you know about it. He uses words like consistency, which is related to certain methodological things. My favorite is coherence, which is that studies conducted by different authors in different ways should get the same answer if it's true. You believe that, right? Like if 10 people run 10 different studies, and it really is true that something is the case, you should see coherence across those studies, right? If one author says climate change is real and another author says it isn't, and they both have really good supporting data, there's a conflict. On the other hand, if the propensity of scientists are getting the same answer that the temperature is increasing, well, that tells you something. Right? You know what I mean? Yeah. Okay, but what I really want to talk about today, and we're going to stop and discuss these things a little bit along the way, is how do randomized controlled trials work? And again, I'm only going through Fisher. The reason I'm going through Fisher is because it's easier. If we started to get through Bradford Hill, the techniques change and it gets a little complicated. Because you have to include epidemiological studies and you have to analyze them differently. Yeah. Sorry, field studies. It means the same thing. They just call it epidemiological. For example, how many of you have heard, we talked about Jon Snow briefly yesterday, it wasn't in the slides, but how many of you have heard of the old studies on cholera that he did? Anybody? Basically, they did all sorts of weird stuff where they, instead of running an experiment where you manipulate stuff, you can't do that, one second, you can't do that because you can't give people cholera, right? That would literally kill them, so you can't do that. So instead, what you have to do is you have to track who's getting the disease and then reverse engineer the causes from it. This is one reason why Bradford Hill is so interesting, because it's like a combination of these features. Some you can manipulate if it's ethical and okay, and other things where you can't manipulate it, can't give somebody cancer, stuff like that, you have to find other ways to get at causality. That's what's so clever about it. Right? In the case of Jon Snow, if you don't know the result, there was this one company that was literally pumping poop into the water, and it was killing lots of people in London, and that's what he found out. It's kind of disgusting, but also true. So, okay. Oh, yes, sorry, go ahead.
I asked about the previous slide, Anna, about this as well. Is it like reasonable to even use language which is like consistent or size?
That's a good question.
Is it reasonable to assume those kind of things?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would answer yes and no, right? You're right that those terms do not perfectly reflect reality, absolutely. And in fact, this is a common problem in experimental design. And we'll talk about it, I can't remember if it's in these slides or different ones, when we get to things like p-values. The problem is, mathematically, what a p-value is very clear, right? If you look at the equation, you say, aha, if you understand the math. However, describing them with English terms just doesn't really work easily. There's no easy way to give you an, I mean, there are ways to describe it, but they're not really intuitive for most people. Even scholars struggle with this a great deal. In fact, I wrote a paper, personally, even though I know the math, I know how it works, and I've done this stuff for a long time, I wrote a paper a number of years ago where I described the p-value in a certain way, and it just isn't quite right, and it bugs me to this day. But it is what it is. It is what it is. So I would say, yes, you have to describe this stuff in English so others can understand, but you have to recognize that no matter what words you use, it will not be perfect. And so you have to kind of just live with that. It's the reality. Okay, so let's talk about how these work. And the goal is to get you to understand that there's different ways of doing an experiment. And there isn't a right way to do the experiment. Sometimes there's wrong ways, but there isn't a right way. Oftentimes, when computer scientists, especially since they don't take classes in methodology, when they first learn about experimental design, their instinct is to say, oh, you did a this kind of test, it should have been a that kind of test. That is wrong. That is not how this works. Different techniques for experimental methodology have pros and cons, and they impact the experiment in different ways, but that doesn't make them right or wrong. It just means that sometimes you might need to do it both ways. But you can't know unless you actually do it, right? So let's look at some names. There is some things that we would call not really experiments, and there's two of them that are classically listed in the literature. There's pre-experimental one-shot case study. You know, it rolls right off the tongue, right? And there is pre-experimental one-group case study. And then there are things that we often call experiments. And there's a lot of these, and we're going to talk about them, and you should try to memorize them as best as you can. You don't have to memorize the names, Well, you should know the techniques, and there's a couple reasons for this. Number one, you see them in the literature when you read this stuff. So if you can read the literature and it says Latin square design, you should instantly know what that means. Otherwise, you can't understand what they did, right? Because you'll be like, what does that mean? Then you have to go look it up and it's big pain. So there's a bunch of them. There's pre-post control group design. The control group is critical. There's post-test only. There's a very well-known one that's not very commonly used called the Sullivan four-group design, sort of very specialized. There's between and within subjects designs. Those are so commonly used in the literature that you have to know what those terms mean. There is the repeated measures design, which is used often to get more statistical power, but has some other downsides. And then there's Ronald Fisher's innovation, which was the Latin square. And that has some other flaws, but it makes some compromises that many scholars believe to be reasonable, but actually the evidence on it is a little debatable. But nonetheless, people do it anyway. Okay. Now, the next thing to think about is that oftentimes with these designs, you don't just memorize their structure. You memorize a notation, and then you can describe all of these studies using the same notation. And this is a standard notation, which comes from a textbook that I forgot to cite, and I don't remember its title. But I can find it in my office when I get home if you really want to know where it comes from. Okay? And this particular standard notation has three symbols in it, plus some Roman numerals. There is an X, which means a group has been exposed to a treatment. A group has been exposed to a treatment. Now, when I say a group has been exposed to a treatment, this might mean different things in different contexts. It might mean someone exists, and then you give them something, and then you observe them again. Or it could mean something else. An O means that there is an observation. An O means there's an observation. An observation means whatever you want. You tested how long it took them to do something. You check their blood pressure. It doesn't matter, right? Anything computer science-y, medically, educationally, you know, they took the SATs, they took an IQ test. It doesn't make any difference. An observation just means you took some kind of measurement and then you tracked it. That's it. This is very general and very generic. An R means that you use random assignment. Broadly speaking, if you have the choice to use random assignment or not, and it's ethical, you should always use random assignment. You should never, unless you have a really good reason, decide to structure your groups in another way, because it's more fair for it to be random. There are exceptions to this. The most crucial one is ethics. Sometimes you can't randomly assign something because of ethics. And that sucks, but it matters. Right? And other times, you can't use random assignment because it's not possible. You can't randomly assign who gets cancer. Right? And if you're working at Microsoft, you can't randomly assign that they use or don't use C#. You cannot do that because you just can't. Like, they're controlled by their corporation. So unless you convince Microsoft to change, that won't work. So there are compromises, and there are good reasons you can't use random assignment. But if you can, you should, because it removes the potential that you're accidentally biasing your samples because you don't control it. That was the core innovation of the Nuremberg Salt Test, which a lot of people, we have learned in detail since. And then finally, we use Roman numerals to represent an experimental group. Now you might say, that's dumb. What if you have 1,000 experimental groups? And the answer is, if you have 1,000 experimental groups, something is wrong with your experiment, because that's way too many experimental groups. And the reason that's too many, as you will discover, is because your statistics are going to be a nightmare, because you're going to have very low power because of the way the math works out. In other words, the way that your math is going to work for your statistics is going to basically, you're going to find nothing. You're going to find spurious results. So you got to be careful. Okay, so let's look at the pre-experimental one-shot case study. X? Oh, X is what? The treatment of some kind, and O is what? Observation. Now, tell me this. What are the pros and cons of a pre-experimental one-shot case study? They might be obvious and they might not. What are the pros and cons? That's the best one. It is easy to do. That sounds maybe dumb to some of you. Why would it matter if it's easy to do? Say what? Yeah, you might need a sense of direction. Why else? Because you got to finish your master's thesis? Study techniques like this are often used because you only have so much time. However, there are obvious cons. And there's a reason why in the literature, sometimes if you have to peer review something and you get a pre-experimental one-shot case study, you say, I'm sorry, I'm going to reject this paper. In fact, literally last night. The editor rejected, not me. But it happens. But why? Why is that a con? What are the cons? Yeah.
Well, if we observe a change of some kind, we can be sure if it's because of the treatment.
Fantastic. That's the best reason. Good. Can anyone think of others? Yeah. Yeah, so I like what you said. Another way to think about it might be that there's other, as they call it, covariates. What's a covariate? Anybody know? Heard this before? Mm-hmm. What do you think? What does that term imply to you? And if you say, dude, I have no idea, that's fine.
Well, I will go for now.
Okay, what do you think? What's a covariate? Yeah, it's the same thing. So what are they talking about there?
When two objects have some kind of connection.
Yeah. Okay, so what are we talking about then? What are covariates in this context? You totally got it. I know it's in your head.
What we have in this case.
Mm-hmm.
But when we use one, when we have one group under treatment,
mm-hmm.
and with each, what is the other object I can understand? We have covariance between what? Between our object and...
You're asking the right questions.
Because I can't understand it, so I can't answer your question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think actually you did a pretty good job. So, because these kind of notations are intentionally vague. They're intentionally not supposed to be tied to an individual experiment, right? In a real experiment, you would have context, and then you could try to guess the covariates. But I don't want you to do that. I want you to understand that for particular kinds of experimental designs, covariates exist naturally despite what kind of experiment you have, right? In this particular case, the covariates are bloody anything because you have no checks and balances. You're not comparing against anything. You're not randomizing anything. You're not controlling certain variables at all. You're just like, hey, I tried this thing and it worked out. Now, remember, I told you the other day that result by Andy Koh. You probably don't remember that, but 44 studies in the field of software engineering, weirdly doubling of the 22, but whatever. Obviously, that's coincidental. But a lot of the studies that came out in that period were just an author tried something themselves from their own people, and then they just said that it was good. That is exactly that. It is a non-experimental technique. It is not evidence that something is good or bad. Get it? Okay. Next, there is a pre-experimental one-group pre-post test. These are insanely common in the literature and terrible, but insanely common. Why are they common? I'll give you the first thing because it's the same answer. Yeah, they're really easy to do. Now, there are ways to try to do these better, right? There's something called test-retest reliability and some stuff like that. But there are, again, what are the pros in a pre-post test model? What do we gain by adding the pre-test here before a treatment? And then let's add it to what you could do this for in computer science so you get an idea. What do you gain with this pre-test? What do you think? You're looking over the trailer, not call me, you bastard.
Yeah. We can compare the observation to the first part.
Yeah, that's right. All of a sudden, we do have a comparison. And the tech comparison is the beginning to the end. I don't know what that noise is. So, let's put this in the context of a computer science experiment. Would someone be willing to try? Name a computer science experiment related to programming languages that would fit this model. There's some really classic ones you see in the literature all the time. But give it a shot. I'll give you a hint. At the beginning of the class, we had students take an exam on programming. The next step would be, we had them take the class on programming, and then the final step would be, we gave them the same exam that they took at the beginning, and lo and behold, the students learned some programming. You have no idea how often that claim specifically is in the literature. And of course, it's probably true, right? Like, you probably learned something in a class. I mean, that's why it's a class. Right? But what does it prove? What can you actually reasonably conclude from a pre-post test? And then what are the pros and cons? So let's do, what can you conclude from a pre-post, first of all? What can you conclude?
Maybe some general connections. It doesn't depend on some context. Maybe it makes a difference.
Whether it makes a difference or not? Can you conclude that? Are you sure?
No, I'm not sure.
It kind of depends. Imagine you had two groups, and this is going to be a terrible experiment, but just imagine this. You had two groups, and in both groups, they either took a class or didn't. They had a test at the beginning and the end. Right? And then one group took the class and the other group didn't, and the group that didn't learn as much. Mm-hmm. That's probably true, right? But did you learn anything from that experiment either? Not really. I mean, of course kids that took a class are going to do it. So the point is, oftentimes with these kind of pre-post tests, if you're going to do one, you have to be really careful that what you're measuring is actually interesting. Even adding a control group doesn't necessarily help if the construct of interest isn't interesting. And that is subjective and hard to figure out sometimes. Another way to think about it is that even once you know how these methodologies work, it's still a lot of work sometimes to figure out how to do it right. One of my old psychology professors used to say, hey, look, Stefik, you've been working on programming for like 2 decades, and you know how to write software in a whole bunch of different ways. I've been doing experiments for 5 decades. I've screwed it up way more than you have. And that's true. Right? So, like, if you've never done an experiment, if you've never actually conducted an experiment before, of course you don't know how to do it. Because it takes a lot of practice. And so, this is one of those areas of computer science where it's probably underrepresented because people don't know how to do it. And then when they do, of course they screw it up because they've never done it before. right? It's just like writing code. You have to kind of do it a lot. Or learning to play the saxophone or whatever it is you do. Welcome. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And maybe yesterday it was like ice cream festival, and we asking the day after, so we have like one result. And when we ask them the same question like a month after, so we can have another result, and is this results will say us something.
That's a good point. And it's actually a good example of where a pre-post test might actually be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to sort of put her stuff into different words. Oftentimes, if you are going to use a pre-post style, you often want to look for things that are non-obvious. In this particular case, you might do something and then a treatment, and then check later to see if the treatment persisted.
Mm-hmm.
That actually can be interesting. For example, even with a class, suppose you had them take a class, and then you tested them 10 years later to see if they still knew the content. Now, all of a sudden, what the results are interesting. And for example, suppose you found that after 10 years they know nothing anymore. Well, that might indicate that maybe the college courses weren't so useful to begin with, right? Or, who knows? You get the idea. Yeah.
I was thinking, like, am I missing something? To me, this seems like the most trivial aspect.
It is. You are not missing anything. That is exactly the point. Yep, you have it exactly right. I'm talking about these particular designs so that when you read a paper where people use them, you immediately know that there's a red flag. That's the point. It doesn't mean the study's a bad study, but it does mean that they better have done their homework because there's immediately a red flag, right? Okay, now there's also four effects that we often call threat to validity that are often mentioned with pre-post tests. There's history, maturation, instrumentation, selection. And for history, that means outside events that may impact the experiment. So for example, in the United States, I guess it's slightly morbid, but that's fine. If you had a test and it was conducted right before 9/11, I mean right after 9/11, the bombing thing in the United States, I mean plane thing, maybe that has an impact on people's perceptions or something. History-style events could have an impact. You don't know, but that's literally the point. And it's also hard to plan for. You can't really. There's maturation. Participants may have grown older or wiser or just changed. A good example is like cancer patients or something. Or with developers, you might learn new languages. Or forget old ones. Both have been documented in the literature. It's not shocking. There's instrumentation effects. This one's tricky. This one means if the pre and post tests are different, how does that impact the results? Right? It might not, but this sort of stuff does happen, especially if you're on like big teams of research. Sometimes you might have to change an instrument for reasons, and some of them might be like ethics or like the laws change on what you can report. For example, I imagine in Europe, I don't know this, but I imagine in Europe, because of GDPR, it wouldn't surprise me if there's at least one researcher that had to change their instrument because of GDPR, and as such, that might have screwed up a study. I don't know if that's true, but it just wouldn't surprise me, right? It's not necessarily a bad thing. But it just means that if you have changes to instruments, you have to take that into account, right? With pre-post tests. And finally, there's selection. And selection means there's potential problems with what kind of people that you gathered. In other words, you're not accounting for anything related to demographics. This type of design does not do that. All it has is a pretest and a post-test. That's it. So there's all sorts of things that can get in the way. This is, again, why these things like Radford Hill were so important, because they tried to take into account all sorts of crazy stuff, as opposed to just, we gave people a test and then we gave it again, which was common when you think about stuff from Fisher. And Fisher was roundly criticized for it. which is one reason why his work wasn't taken seriously for decades. For good reason. Okay, now getting back to notation, this is a pre-post control group design. And you'll notice the notation now. On the top, we've got 0x0 and 0,0. That's the control group. And on the bottom, we've got these little R's, which are what? Random. Now, in this particular context, the notation is a little bonkers. If you had only one R, what would that mean? It would mean syntax error. Because that makes no sense. How do you randomly assign people to only that group? That, what does that mean? By definition, there would, what would the other people be? Like, I don't know what that means. So, the point is, the notation is a little bonkers, but what it means is that if you've got these two little R's, you're randomly assigning between those two groups. You're not selecting them. You're not choosing them. It's random. Now, to be clear, when we say random, this is always a point of contention in peer review as well. Random doesn't mean you found a list of all 7 billion people on planet Earth, and then you randomly selected them, and then you called them and you flew them in. That's unlikely to be effective as a recruitment strategy. And I don't know of a list of 7 billion people, and if there was such a list, that's really creepy. What it means is that for the selection that you do have, you put them in the groups randomly. That's it. If you want to talk about how you get the people that go into that list, that's not selection, that's sampling. Right? Random selection is this. Random sampling is a technique for doing that across some population. So just in your head, make sure you understand the concept of selection versus sampling. Those are different. Okay, so same discussion. Pros and cons on the bottom one. Ignore the top one for now. On the bottom one, what are the pros and cons of this approach? What does it do that the others didn't do? It adds one check and balance. What is that one check and balance here? Actually, two with the randomness. Compared to the pre-post treatment, what does this do?
You can actually draw conclusions about.
Yeah, you're manipulating one variable, so in theory you can draw connections about that one variable. Right? Now, can there still be covariates? Can there be things that infect that one variable that you didn't account for? You bet. Having a control group is not magic. It doesn't make sure that you took everything else into account. There are classic studies about this happening, but I'm sure you can just kind of imagine. Oh, no, not quite. So I didn't actually include sampling procedures in any of my slides. I do teach it usually, but it's not here because we just didn't have time. But this is why I'm talking about this distinction between sampling and selection. So for the sake of argument, suppose you somehow got a sample from a group. Like maybe you're studying Native American programmers for some reason. There actually are some studies. It's kind of fascinating. But never mind that. Once you get that sample, you split them in two randomly. That's what it's saying. But what you were talking about for the second part of what you said is taking two populations and selecting them randomly there. There are ways to do that kind of stuff, but that's not what we're talking about. Normally, you get the total selection and the total sample that you want, and then you split those randomly. There are exceptions. The most common way to think of those exceptions is if you have to, for some reason, distinguish them. A good example is what's called a stratified random sample. It's not in the slides, but I'll just tell you really quick. A stratified random sample is often used in things, something like education. For example, I can't necessarily randomly sample who goes in what class, because they might be like a freshman and a junior. What do? You can't do anything about it. Or I can't swap randomly which student is at which school. That doesn't make sense. I can't do that. So stratified just means random but within constraints. And it's sort of one of these things in empirical science where you can argue it's bad, but you also have to argue about reality. And like you can't fix everything, so you have to sort of accept the fact that science is imperfect. Right? Okay. Okay, now there's also this thing that's sometimes called a post-test only control group design. And you can see how this notation starts to get a little bit useful, right? Because now you don't really need to know the name. What you really need to know is how the experiment's put together. And so you can look at a notation and say, oh, it's that kind of design. I kind of get it. I do a treatment for these people and then an observation. Those people, I just do the observation at the same time. That's it. Pros and cons, post-test only. These are really common. These aren't bad. Pros and cons. What do you think? What does the randomization have to do with before? Well, I don't think that would impact the pretest. That is actually a true problem, absolutely. In fact, it happened in the tolbutamide trials. I think we talked about that yesterday. There's strong evidence that actually occurred. But so it's a legitimate issue, but I don't think it's related to pretest, unless I'm missing something. What is your argument? That's true, but in this one, couldn't that same thing occur whether you measure them once or twice or 10 times?
True, but you might notice it.
You're saying because you have more measurements, you might notice it? Possibly.
You know, you can control
for it. Well, how? For example, in the tolbutamide trials, which actually use this, do this, give some of them tolbutamide, and then do that again. They didn't notice until they'd done a bunch of these zeros and X's, right? Because then they noticed that, oh, shoot, this has like a, there's a heart condition here. But I don't think they noticed that because of that. They just noticed it over time as they did covariates. Anyway, maybe it's a moot point, but I'm just thinking that, yeah.
Just one question related to the phases. What about time? Like different times might happen.
That's called history. That is a history effect. You got that. So that 100% legitimate is called a history effect. All right. This one's tricky. Oh, any other comments on the just the post only? Yeah.
Observation, as I understood. It's like the same problem with cancer and smoking. So we have observation, we have observation group, and we check something, but maybe there are other reasons, and we can't control it.
That's right. So you still have the covariate problem. Mm-hmm. None of the designs so far fix the covariate problem, right? And that's 100% true. I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow. Say that again.
Like, for example, if you want, having the phase one error node, so why not do error node again in order to see just like the history effect? If you change the test, then how do you know which one is the history effect and which one is the
You don't. Yeah, that's one of the downsides. Yeah. Of these kind of techniques, you don't know the history effect. In fact, you can have a history effect even only doing it once, right? Like maybe there's some crazy thing in history that happens right before there. Mm-hmm. Your dog died ahead of time. I think we have a new person. I didn't know. Hi, what's your name?
Okay.
I didn't judge.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, sounds good. I guess there's a sign-up sheet.
Okay.
Where we've added students during the class, how strange. So, cool. You're not the only one, so. Okay, but in any case, although you could argue semantically that one of these is better than the other, honestly, I think they're pretty much the same. It just kind of depends what you're measuring. They're not really good or bad. They're just kind of other techniques you can use depending upon what you are trying to find out. The important thing is you want to randomize. That's important. But whether you have a pretest or not is kind of in the wash, I would say. All right, now, there is a study that was actually developed by this guy named Solomon. The original experiment was weird and silly, and you would never really do it, related to sensory deprivation of people. It didn't actually occur. That's not really the point. However, it was given a name and has become relatively famous. It's called the Solomon four-group design. And the reason it's famous is not because you really use it. Most people don't. Solomon four-group design is very rare. To put it in perspective, in like the 15 years or so that I've been either publishing or looking at the literature, I've never seen a Solomon four-group design once in computer science. Never. In fact, now that I think about it, I don't think I've ever even seen a paper cited that talk about a Solomon four-group design. Now, I think part of the problem is just computer scientists don't know methodology. So, like, they wouldn't have even heard of it or know what to do. That said, it is interesting because the Solomon four-group design starts to get at this idea of covariates. Now, to be clear, the way Bradford Hill tackles covariates is way better than this, which is why it's not that relevant. However, it does take care of certain kinds of things that you might be interested in for an experiment, and as such, you should at least know of its existence, the Solomon four-group design. So let's break it down. What I want to do for this one, because it's a little complicated, I want to take a second and spend about 2 minutes. I want you to talk about it in your groups, figure out what those conditions are and why they're there, and then let's go back and talk about it. Okay? So because the Solomon four-group design is a little complicated, I want you to look at each of those four groups, figure out why on earth they included those ones specifically, and then let's come back and talk about it. Okay? So 2 minutes. And you can join whichever group you want. You heard of this one?
No.
Oh, okay. I've never seen this site in computer
Yeah,
I'm And the conclusion we come to is that.
No, but they also.
Because it's
more stressful.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fair. And also because there's only four things. Okay, we're out of time. Okay, 2 minutes are up. So what I want to do is I'm going to go talk to one group, and each of you will do one of the four. Now, you may not have gotten to all four. But what I want you to think about and answer is, why did this Solomon fellow include that particular experimental group? So I'm going to start with you folks. I'm going to do the top one. Why that one? Comparison to the others.
Yeah, well, it's pretty obvious. You first observate, then you do the experiment, and then compare last observate with the first one.
Yeah, it feels thorough, right?
Yeah.
Like we're going to, yeah. Okay, good. Now there's the second one. Why include that one? Your group.
You want to study whether taking an observation.
Very good. That's excellent. Basically, the idea is maybe that first observation caused a change. Right? Okay, and the third one, you folks?
That's to observe what kind of change, in a way, there is without the change.
You've got it. It's a control group, but both assessments. And then in the back, I'm sure this one's obvious at this point, but give it a shot.
Yeah, well, it's control for the observation.
Yeah. Now, can you think of any criticisms of the Solomon Four group design? This does account for certain kinds of effects, but definitely not the kinds of ones that Bradford Hill cared about. What's the criticism of Solomon Four group design then? It's maybe not obvious, I'm not sure. What do you think? What's a criticism of this? There's a couple. In fact, one of them would be the opposite of what you said a few times.
It's kind of complicated.
It's complicated, right? Now, once you start digging into R, you'll also learn it has a second nasty side effect. It actually lowers statistical power for reasons that we can get into. And trust me, when you only get so many people to participate in your studies, you must consider statistical power. You absolutely have to, because you can't recruit a million programmers. If you get 50, it's a good day, right? That's just reality. Like, you can't just call Microsoft and say, hey, you have 10K programmers, can you all have them do this task for me? They'll be like, no, who are you? Why did you call a switchboard to Microsoft?
$1 million.
Say what?
I have $1 million, please do it.
Yeah, right, I don't know if they would, but maybe. Anyway, you get the idea, right? Another criticism is that the idea here is good in the sense that we're trying to tackle covariates. However, the problem is, are they the right covariates? Like, are these the covariates that matter or not? What do you think? They might? That's right, they might. Yeah, maybe like, maybe in the medical community, they have to do this like really nasty like spinal test or something, and it could really hurt you. Then maybe. But what about in computer science? Is having them do a pretest probably going to cause any long-term effects? Maybe. It depends. That's the biggest one. They might learn. So you do have to take that into account. But nonetheless, it's usually not dangerous. It's just, it's tricky. So this does take into account other effects. Well, you have to remember, they may not be the ones you care about for your research. And so the most important thing is what effects matter as opposed to just what were the ones Solomon came up with, right? But nonetheless, it's good to know about this because it's the first lesson you get in, how do I tackle one kind of covariate? All right, now there's two kinds of tests that you should know about, and you should know the names by heart because they're really common. And that's between and within subjects. And there's classic designs that you do with them that you just have to know because they're so ridiculously common. Painfully, obviously, there's thousands of papers that can be cited that use these. They are very, very common. In a between subjects test, it means you have a control group, one group does one thing, the other group does the other. In this case, I've marked this as two observations without an explicit treatment, but the reality is that one of those groups is the treatment. So it's a little bit weird to write it this way, but that's what I mean by that notation. That's my intended meaning. I'm playing the role of mathematician there, where I'm using symbols to give you a meaning. You might disagree with my symbols, but you should understand the meaning. So in this particular case, an example for programming languages might be, I have one programming language that is statically typed and the other that is dynamic. Or I might have one language where I just remove the annotations or something like that. I have one language with this syntax, another language with some other syntax. Or I have one language with a syntax and one that varies the syntax slightly. Whatever it is, right? The nice thing about this design that I think a reason students often go to it is, again, what is it? It is super simple, right? The other thing that's nice that students really like is that statistically, it's ridiculously easy to do the statistics. There's one test you run called the t-test, and then you're done. Most of the time. It's not really that simple, but that's commonly what a student might do if they haven't, you know, done a lot of experiments. It's a good first test. Running a t-test is a good first example. So in any case, the point is, between subjects means one group does one, another group does another. That's it. Now, does a between subjects design have to be two groups? What do you think? What do you think? Does it have to be two groups? What's your name again? Yeah. Yeah, okay. Say it one more time.
Mahinda.
Mahinda.
Yes.
Did I pronounce it even in the ballpark? Okay. How, if I wanted to change this notation to have three groups, what would I do? I just add a Roman numeral, put three, put an R, and another O. And say what the group is. That's it. Three groups. How many groups can I have?
As many as you want.
As many as you want, but why would I not want to have a lot of them? Other than complexity. Other than the fact that, like, that's just damn confusing. There's a really good reason, statistically, that I don't want lots of experimental groups. Anybody know what it is? Overfitting? No, it's not an overfitting issue. That's a good thing to know about, but that's not what it is.
Well, I mean, so you claim that is not a thing, that you're like wanting to observe more than there actually is.
Yeah, that's a true thing, just not related to this particular issue. Yeah.
Maybe like this tracks if you want to compare something to another, and then you have like 50 groups, so then you lose the comparison because there are so many varieties.
That's true. It's a complexity issue, but actually that's also not what I'm thinking of. The issue is, again, you lose statistical power. The more groups you have, the more participants you need. And there's some equations you can look at to realize that that's true. But the point is, whenever you're designing experiments, there's a temptation among students to say, I'm going to have 50 groups, and I'm going to do all sorts of stuff, But then they come to realize, oh, I get one person per group. If I have a sample size of 50, I'm going to need 2,500 people to run this experiment. So you got to be really careful. Unless you have access to a giant pool of participants, keep your experiment simple. One, two groups, three groups, and maybe not much more, bless you. Does that make sense? You're going to screw up your statistics if you make your experiment really complicated. Screw up meaning lower your statistical power. And also, the tests get more complicated, too, and you have to kind of know what you're doing. Right? They're not hard, but like they take practice. Okay, now there's also within subject designs, and in this particular one, I changed my notation. I did that on purpose because I'm trying to make it related to a specific experiment, static and dynamic typing. S, God, that's annoying. S is a statically typed thing, and D is dynamic in this case. It's a specific experiment, but you could also say it's A and B. If I do this experiment, I'm having the same group do both tasks. Why would you do that? There's a really good reason. Can you think of it? What do you think of that? Why might you consider doing that? It's a very common technique. It's not bad. Okay? Anybody want to take a shot at it? What do you think? Yeah, it's still a control. You still get a comparison. That's true. As it turns out, if the other having lots of groups lowered statistical power, this raises statistical power. Because you have all of your participants doing all of the tasks. Right? So you get more data for each task. However, there's a huge problem. What is that problem? Can anyone see it? What do you think, new student, that I can't remember your name? What is it again?
My name's Natalie.
Natalie.
Yeah, Natalie.
Okay, what do you think?
I think that the order might matter.
Aha! Brilliant! That is exactly correct. Which group has the advantage? Dynamic does. How much of an advantage? Can we quantify it? Unfortunately, it turns out the answer is a big advantage. And it's unknowable depending on the experiment. You have to actually run it to find out. However, there's even commonly used phrases that are something called the power law of practice, because sometimes these advantages are so big, they're exponential. So like, if you do an experiment this way, you are grotesquely biasing your data. Grotesquely biasing your data. But there's a common fix called counterbalancing. And it is not perfect. Notably, one group has static first, and the other group has dynamic first. Now, that is an improvement. You do have to do some funny stuff statistically, but ignore that for a moment. But there is a way that this could still be screwed up. Can anyone see what it is? What is it? What could the problem be? What do you think? Yeah. What's your name again?
Mitri. You should account for the subject because somewhat, like, you should use some hierarchical method to analyze this.
Maybe.
Because you measure one person to, like,
oh, individual differences type
thing?
Yes. That's actually possible. There's another issue that's more commonly cited, but that is true. Anyone see what it might be? What if, for the sake of argument, by doing this task first, it gives you a 500% advantage to going there, but this one only gives you a 200% advantage to go there? If the learning effect is not equal, the experiment has failed. So how do you know that the learning effect is equal? You don't. Without measuring it. unfortunately. And actually measuring it accurately requires something that's called isomorphism. Has anyone heard this term? It's kind of a weird term. Isomorphism. What does that mean? Anyone heard it? How many of you have heard the term before? Yeah. How many of you have never heard the term isomorphism? Okay. What does it mean? You heard it. What does it mean? Oh, you just heard it. Okay. Isomorphism means that the tasks have to be roughly equivalent. In other words, the tasks that you're doing here don't have to be the same necessarily, but they have to basically have the same properties. A good example is that if you had two IQ tests to test intelligence, they should measure the same thing and get the same answer, even if they're very different. That would be an isomorphic test. Maybe they're totally different tests so that you can reuse them, but they give you the same answer every time, or similar answers. That's isomorphism. But if your tasks are not isomorphic, you can't even do this kind of study. It just doesn't make sense. But again, the big advantage is, since every single person is doing the stuff from both groups, it doubles statistical power by definition. That matters a whole lot. So you especially see designs like this when you have low sample sizes, which is really common if you're doing a master's thesis. So oftentimes when people do something like a thesis, they end up doing basically a counterbalance within subject design because they're really simple. You know, you just have two groups. It's really not that complicated. And it raises statistical power, which is helpful when you're trying to get an answer. So,
is the isomorphism actually like normal, like when it occurs? Because
excellent question.
This is like very unclear.
Excellent question. And the answer is, if the answer is no, it is not normal. However, teams that do this professionally that want their tests to be very reliable, they test the isomorphism in a separate study. And a good example of that is, again, IQ tests. If you want your IQ tests to be reliable, they have studied that at length. IQ tests are not perfect. They have their flaws. But that's not the point. The point is what is called the psychometric properties of the test are well-established and well-known. In some cases, like if you want to get I think it's tier one, under the ESSA law through the Department of Education in the United States grant, I know that's a mouthful, sorry, you have to prove that your tests are isomorphic. That requires evidence. So you can't just run your study and hope for the best. You have to run your study and you have to know that your tests are fair, which makes sense, right? Otherwise, they say, well, you can't scale to a larger sample. We're not going to give you money to do that because you need to know that your tests are fair first. That makes sense. Hence, chairs of evidence. Anyway, questions on this? Do you get between subjects and counterbalanced within subjects? Okay, just a couple more. Repeated measures design. Okay, now we've talked about statistical power. For the next 2 minutes, I want you to talk about this particular test within the context of statistical power and try to figure out if it raises it or lowers it. Go. Two minutes. Raises it or lowers it, and then think of the pros and cons too if you figure that out.
one of the kind of
figured it out?
No.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and stop. By show of hands, how many people say it raises statistical power? How many people say it lowers statistical power? How many people say it has no impact on statistical power? How many people did not raise their hand? Okay. Why would this raise or lower? What would be the reason? If it raised it, now I think I saw your hand up. Why would it raise statistical power? And what does that even mean? Maybe that's the confusion.
You kind of thought in the end you end up with more results in writing?
That is why it raises statistical power. That is the correct answer. Think about it. Statistical power is really a function of how much data you have on your particular condition. In this particular case, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 measurements, observations, of a particular group. You have 7 data points per person. And in the other group, you have 7 data points per person. As such, you have more data, and you have raised statistical power.
The reason I didn't answer either is because I was thinking of what if there's causality between them.
Aha! That's an excellent point and 100% true, and we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that once we get to the statistical testing. There are standard tests that take that into account. One of them is called a repeated measures ANOVA, and we'll get to that. However, the point is, I'm really glad you mentioned it, because it's completely true. It could be the case that these correlate. It could also be the case that these don't give a consistent answer. And it could be the case that these are not isomorphic, and it could be the case that there's learning effects as you go. So I want to draw really quick. Now, we'll have a discussion. Weird, it's like actual chalk. I haven't seen this in the United States in like 20 years. Okay. Strange. Just really quick, just want to briefly just draw. Imagine that you had a graph of A and B of these two groups. For example, you could have that in time to complete for group one, and you could have that, right? But you can see how this gets, even though it's more statistical power, things start to get complicated. What if you had this? What does that mean? This happens all the time. What does it mean? If this is group one, and this is group two, what does that mean? All of a sudden, the hard part with the repeated measures design is that you have to interpret whatever the hell it does. And it ain't always obvious. So, you do gain statistical power, and as such, these techniques are used pretty regularly. However, what you lose is easy interpretation of your data. This particular factor is a standard name, if you don't know it. It's called an interaction effect. And R automatically calculates this effect. And if you look at R and you have these treatments, you'll have a value here, and a p-value. We'll talk about this later. You'll have a value here and a p-value. And then you'll have this thing that says A cross B, and you'll have a p-value. And this A cross B here is a measure of that, how crossed it is. It's a measure of that. Does that make sense? When you interpret these, you always interpret the interaction effect first, because it can grotesquely manipulate what these effects mean. So if you don't interpret that one first, you might actually be saying something totally wrong in terms of what your data means. So you have to be really careful when you do this kind of design. In other words, it's a powerful technique, it's very useful, but it does have consequences, and you have to be aware of them and know how to deal with them. It's non-trivial. Oh, by the way, I should have said, the hard one is when you get that. That's not even a function, but you get the idea, right? Then you're just like, okay, we're screwed, we learned nothing, right? Even if you find something statistically significant, you're kind of like, all right, back to the drawing board, let's try a different experiment, right? All right, only a couple more. This particular one is called a full factorial design. If you're doing a full factorial design, you're probably doing it wrong because it's too hard to interpret. But if you had three groups, you can notice that the orderings cover all the orderings. The problem, though, is that if you've got four variables, what do you get, 16? It grows real fast. It's just not practical. And as well, this is another reason. Oh, does this raise or lower statistical power? How many people say raise? How many people say it lowers? Oh, okay, we need 2 minutes. 2 minutes, figure it out. Right? Why does it raise or lower? You can calculate whether it raises or lowers just by looking at this picture. The Roman numerals are the groups.
Oh, okay. So what does it mean, like, for the group from G1 to
G2? That means G, oh, yeah, I should say that. G, I'm sorry, that's, the notation's funny. That's like condition one, condition two.
Okay.
So it's like a separate treatment type thing. Static, dynamic, and inferred, or whatever, right? Okay. Now it is a little tricky to figure out whether it raises or lowers power here. And there's two different perspectives that you can think about raising and lower powering from. From one perspective is the experimental groups, 1, 2, or 3. Does it raise or lower statistical power from that? Who says it raises? Who says it lowers? Who says it has no impact? The answer is it has no impact. All groups are doing all three tasks, all three conditions. Now, suppose you care about the ordering, which is the purpose of doing a full factorial design. You care about this ordering somehow. Does it raise or lower statistical power for the experiment as a whole? It would lower it because you're covering all of them. So you have less participants in each one because you have six groups. If you have a sample size of n, the number of people in each group is n over 6. If we had three groups, it would be n over 3. Therefore, less data per group. You'll see why this matters when we do the next one, which is the Latin square. In the case of a Latin square, the idea was this. Fisher argued, and I think it's debatable that he's correct, but he argued that even though you have a full factorial design possible, in practice, a full factorial is impractical. If you have three variables, yes, it's this many orderings. If you have four, it's a lot more. If you have five, and it grows exponentially. I mean, it grows very quickly. Right? I think it's a factorial, probably, right? I don't even know. You can figure it out in a few minutes. I just don't want to bother to think about it. But I bet you can figure it out. So what he said was, let's just take a subset of these orderings and call it a day. So you'll notice, in this case, the orderings that he chose were G1, G2, G3, and then cycle them. Question one for a discussion, 1 minute. Is this cycling fair? Like maybe there's other orderings that matter more. So talk about that. Is this cycling fair? You know, we're removing orderings, right? Is that fair? Talk about that. 1 minute. Okay, so, is it fair, the cycling? Who says yes? Who says no? Who says it doesn't matter at all? And who says, I really have no idea? The answer is, unfortunately, nobody really knows. And it probably depends on the experiment. But we don't know. And apparently that's what you thought as well. And the reason is because you can't really know what impact those orderings would have for a particular experiment unless you ran the experiment, right? It's like you could probably even devise an arbitrary experiment that would intentionally manipulate those orderings, which would cause it to have some effect. But that means the only reason people use Latin squares is because they're practical. Even though there is this ordering issue, many people in the literature just flat out ignore it because you can't have 1,000 orderings that lower statistical power too much. And so this is not a perfect thing. But in experimentation, you almost never have the luxury of it being perfect. There is no such thing as perfect. It makes publishing slightly tricky because you have to basically argue that one particular procedure or another is okay. But on the other hand, this is one reason why people like, bless you, Bradford Hill would argue you need to make your studies replicable because then other teams can test it in different ways. Now, no one experiment has to test all permutations. That's not possible in science. Instead, what you go for is, I want my study to be as replicable and correct as possible for the conditions I had. And I want any other team to be able to take those conditions, vary it a little bit, rerun it, and see if they get the same answer. And if they do, that's coherence from Bradford Hill's perspective. Really, today, it's just replication. That's really what people are talking about. Get it? Okay. So the point isn't to say full factorial is bad and Latin square is good. That's really not the point. The point is that if you're worried that ordering is having a big impact in your experiment, these are techniques that you can use. If you don't think ordering is a big deal, or you have evidence that ordering is not a big deal, then you can ignore this issue and not worry about it. But if you know about it, then you have a way to counter it. And at the same time, this also tells you if you do a within subjects test to raise your statistical power, you bare minimum must counterbalance. That's really important. You should never do this technique, which is within subjects without counterbalancing. You will get picked on in the literature easily. It's just an obvious red flag. Like if I saw a paper like that, I'd just immediately reject it and toss it aside and say, redo the experiment, because it's just not fair. You're obviously trying to manipulate it so that the D is better. So I'm just going to reject the paper as a scientist, because it's unfair, right? Whatever your condition is, unless there's some reason why ethically you have to, like some external thing you can't control. But if it's just a normal experiment, you know. Okay, so we've talked about experimental design, and I've given you kind of a quick primer. Like I said, this is like up till like 1930. There's a lot better stuff. This is bare bones, the kind of stuff you would see in the literature right off the top. It doesn't cover doing any kind of covariate analysis. It doesn't cover doing any kind of factorial designs. But I talk about full factorial, but that's not what a factor analysis is. Those are tricky. They're like for design tests for handling, we have like 400 variables. Those are really tricky. And you have to do special things when you have that kind of data. And there's some reliability complexity. And it also doesn't cover doing anything related to evidence standards, which is the modern technique, right? How you report and anything like that. However, I've done two things to try to help you get past 1930 in case you want to learn. And that is, besides a lot of the citations and stuff that are in there, I also put in a recent paper, which you may or may not have seen. And this is a paper that's not even out yet, but it follows consort format for an experiment. And it uses a repeated measures design in this particular case. That doesn't mean this design is better or worse. It just means that's what we did. But the point is, if you dig through, even if you're not interested in the topic, it will show you exactly how to report every little detail of how your experiment was put together. So that when you, if you go off for a master's thesis or something and you're designing an experiment, you can say, okay, this is a standard paper that uses a standard way to do reporting that covers their statistics in a standard way. And you can use it as a template for your designing your own stuff. That's why I put it in there for you, even if it's totally unrelated to the stuff you care about. Does that make sense? So that way you don't have to like try to read complicated medical jargon and interpret that for computer science, because it is a little tricky if you've never done it before. So this is an example of the kind of interventions that you would use in modern times, as opposed to just the stuff we talked about, which is up to about 1930. Okay. So that concludes our stuff. Oh, wow, wait, we're done at 10, aren't we?
Yeah.
Oh, crud.
So we have kind of time to help us.
Okay.
But we're over time at 10.
I was thinking, I went a little long. Sorry about that. Okay. Well, then, this is what we're going to do then, because we have to go up and do a talk. I have to go up and do a talk pretty soon, which all of you are welcome to go to. I don't even know where it is.
Here.
Oh, well, apparently it's here. In a half hour, there's a talk. But before 1 o'clock, if you have time, like you can go to lunch together or whatever you want to do. You don't have to. What you want to start thinking about is how do you take the tasks and stuff that you have and fit them into a particular experimental design? Because you have to choose one for Friday, right? You have to physically like do the experiment. So are you going to do it between subjects, within subjects? I don't know. My advice, make it simple. If you can do only two groups, do that. If you need more, that's okay. But if you can limit the number of groups, that's good for statistical power. Because we will have low sample size, consider doing within subjects. If it will screw up your experiment because you don't want people to know the other groups, then don't do that. But realize it'll cut your power in third for each group. That's the point. Consider doing within subjects counterbalanced. And consider keeping the number of groups small. Right? If not, then consider doing repeated measures and just know that it'll help make your statistics harder. And that's okay, I'll show you how to do it, but still. Does that make sense? So before 1 o'clock, if you have time, and if you don't, that's okay, see if you can't map out what your experimental design will be and put it into the standard notation so that you know what your experiment looks like. Does that make sense? All right, give it a shot. And then when we come back at 1, why don't we start with looking at what everybody came up with. And if you didn't have quite time, then we'll spend a little bit of time then and do it before we jump into R, just so we don't miss out on it. The point is, figure out what your experimental design will be and put it into standard notation so we know what your experiment will be. Because that'll tell you how many tasks you need and all that kind of stuff. So we'll need to do that too. We're building an experiment as well. You may not like our experiment, but we've got something. It's a start. I like it, but you know, you may not. And it's okay if you don't like it. You can tell us. We'll change it. Okay, let's bugger off, and then I'll see you all at 1. Or if you'd like to see the talk at 1:30,